Thanks for tuning in for the July 2nd podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's featured interview highlights current treatment practice of Guillain-Barré syndrome. In the What's Trending segment, you'll hear a discussion on a neurology genetics article looking at how somatic expansion of the C9ORF72 hexanucleotide repeat does not occur in ALS spinal cord tissues.
Hi, this is Michelle Mauerman from the Department of Neurology at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Bart Jacobs from the Departments of Neurology and Immunology at the University Medical Center in Rotterdam, the Netherlands. We're going to be discussing a paper published in this week's issue of Neurology titled Current Treatment Practice of Guillain-Barré Syndrome. Dr. Jacobs, in just a few words, can you summarize the main important findings from the International GBS Outcome Study regarding the treatment of Guillain-Barré Syndrome patients?
Sure. The International GBS Outcome Study, or IGOS, is a prospective observational multicenter cohort study where we aim to define the clinical and biological determinants that explain a variation in the clinical course of GBS. And one of the important possible determinants of this clinical course, of course, is the difference in treatment that is provided. And in the current study, we have used the data from the first 1,300 patients included in IGOS to investigate the current treatment practice. 154 centers from 19 countries participated in the study. Most of them are expertise or university centers, but there are also smaller hospitals participating. And we have two important general findings. The first is that we found a considerable variation in the current treatment of GBS among the clinical neurologists in the IGOS consortium. And the second one is that patients with a mild or a variant form of GBS were frequently treated with IVIG, although there's at present no randomized controlled trial that has demonstrated this effect for the subgroup of patients. Also, patients without recovery after the first treatment in current practice are frequently receiving a second treatment. But again, there's no comparative trial that has demonstrated such an additional treatment is effective.
Great. You brought up the point that a lot of patients you found with mild GBS and variant forms were treated. What do you think this means in terms of future research?
Yes, I think that's an important question. Maybe I first have to say that mild GBS was defined as patients that were still able to walk independently. And the study showed that 75% of these patients already is receiving treatment, largely IVIG. And we found the same proportion of patients with the Miller-Fisher syndrome or other variants. And well, I was a bit surprised by that because I understand that doctors treat these patients considering that they may further deteriorate or become even a severe form of GBS. And of course, also these patients may have considerable deficits. I remember a patient that I've seen had GBS with a mild form as a child. That was a person who had facial palsy with minor weakness of the limbs and still able to walk. But I saw her as a second opinion about 10 years later, and she still had a very severe facial weakness, and that had a major impact on her life. And she even indicated to me that she would have preferred to walk with a stick. So there can be severe consequences of mild GBS, but on the other hand, there is no RCT available that supports that IVIG is really effective in these variant forms or in these mild forms, and such studies should be done. And I think our study is important to demonstrate that the current standard already is to treat patients, and of course, that may complicate such future research of finding the best treatments.
How do you recommend a patient with GBS who's not responding to treatment in those first few weeks? How do you recommend they should be treated, or do we really know?
Yeah, that's an important question and a very difficult question to answer because there's so little evidence for that. Coming back to the study again, so we showed that in a subgroup of patients with severe form of GBS who did not show any recovery after the first treatment, that 35% of these patients received a second treatment with either IVIG or plasmic change. And some of these doctors gave a second course of IVIG and others switched from IVIG to plasmic change or vice versa. But I think the unresponsive patient with GBS is a true true dilemma for clinical neurologists, because on the one hand, it's known that some of these patients have a poor prognosis. Some of them are even on a ventilator for months or die from the disease. But of course, as a neurologist, you would like to help especially these patients as good as possible. But on the other hand, again, the additional effect of a second treatment is not known. There's no literature on that. And you have to say that IVIG is relatively safe, but serious complications have occurred after repetitive courses of IVIG. In the Netherlands, we have recently finalized a randomized controlled trial in patients with a poor predicted outcome, in which we randomized the patient for a second IVIG course or placebo after IVIG, and we are currently analyzing the data.
So one final question, just let me give you a chance to tell our listeners what in particular they should be on the lookout for when reading the paper after listening to this interview.
I think there's a lot to learn from this publication. I think what was a striking observation to me was that also Bangladesh participated in this multicenter trial, and that in that country, 85% of the patients received no IVIG or plasma exchange because of the high cost. And that made us realize that for, I think, about half of the patients worldwide with GBS, they are probably in the same situation, not giving any IVIG or plasma exchange, and they are only getting supportive care, including mechanical ventilation. But as you can imagine, the mortality rate in those patients is exceptionally high. I think the good news is that there are some recent initiatives to develop treatment also for patients in those countries. And those treatments are at least 20 times less expensive than IVIG, and they seem to be safe, but now the efficacy needs to be tested in independent randomized controlled trials, and that is what's going to happen in the next year. I think another important thing is that I hope the readers will understand that there is definitely a need for conducting more treatment trials in GBS and for developing an international consensus guideline for the treatment of GBS, because the variation at present is extensive. And I hope that it will be possible to use the ICOS data for future comparative studies where patients are compared with different treatment regimens. Of course, that cannot replace a randomized controlled trial, but if there's no other evidence that may give support for certain policies of treatment. So maybe the reader can think about that as well. And yeah, last but not least, I would like to thank my colleagues in the ICOS consortium who have contributed to the collection and analysis of these data. It was great teamwork, and it illustrates, I think, the power of international collaboration.
That's great. Thanks so much. I've been speaking today with Dr. Bart Jacobs regarding his paper titled Current Treatment Practice of Guillain-Barré Syndrome. Thanks for joining.
Hi, this is Matthew Harms, a neurologist from the Eleanor and Lou Gehrig's ALS Center at Columbia University. And today I am interviewing a fellow neurogeneticist, Dr. Guy Rouleau, who is the director of the Montreal Neurological Institute. And we're going to be discussing his paper that was published earlier this spring in Neurology Genetics titled Somatic Expansion of the C9ORF72 Hexanucleotide Repeat Does Not Occur in ALS Spinal Cord Tissues. In the last few years, technology has allowed researchers really to sequence the genomes of individual neurons from across different brain regions and developmental ages. And these studies have been really fascinating in revealing an astonishing number of DNA mutations that are unique, some to small populations of neurons and some even to single neurons. Aside from just being mind-blowingly interesting, why should neurologists pay close attention to this emerging data about neuronal genomic diversity and the idea of accumulating somatic mutations?
Yeah, I think they should follow this field because somatic mutations are very, very frequent, and they're responsible for an increasing number of neurological diseases. So, for example, there are some forms of temporal lobe epilepsy that are the result of somatic mutations. Most brain tumors are the result of somatic mutations. Cavernous angiomas involve somatic mutations, and possibly other diseases such as aneurysms. So somatic mutations are a cause of neurological disease, that's for sure. And given that there are genetic forms of different neurodegenerative diseases, it's possible that somatic mutations may be responsible for some cases of sporadic Alzheimer's or sporadic Parkinson's or sporadic ALS.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So your study, the one we're talking about today, focused on repeat expansions in C9ORF72. As many people know, these are the most common cause of ALS, frontotemporal dementia, and then patients who have a combination of those two diseases. And these expansions are usually detected by looking and testing for them in the blood. Your study, however, tried to take a look for them in the spinal cord of people who'd already tested negative. What led you to conduct this study, and what did it end up finding?
Well, we know that in many expanded repeat diseases like Huntington's and some forms of spinocerebellar ataxia and other diseases like myotonic dystrophy, the repeats are unstable. There is also evidence that shows that the C9ORF72 repeat may also be unstable. So the question we asked, the reason we wanted to look at this is the C9ORF72 repeat somatically stable when you consider the repeat at the normal range of size? Or is it somatically unstable? And if it's somatically unstable, then the idea is that perhaps there would be a somatic mutation that would occur with an expansion of C9ORF72 in a cell, which would then lead to a population of cells in the CNS, for example, in the spinal cord, and that it would lead to a part of the spinal cord having a mutation which predisposes to ALS. And then the idea is that this region would subsequently degenerate. And then with the degeneration, you would end up by producing these misfolded proteins that would then spread out through the CNS. So the idea is, given that repeats are unstable, maybe this one's unstable and maybe somatic mutations of this repeat could explain cases of sporadic ALS.
And when you looked in those spinal cords, did you find evidence for that?
We did not. What we found was that the repeats were very, very stable in different regions of the spinal cord. So what we did is we looked at over 1,000 pieces of spinal cord from 19 people, and we looked at the size of the variant of the repeat of C9ORF72, and then we compared in the same individual all the different spinal cord segments to see if there was any difference, and we didn't find any difference. Of course, it could be that there is an expansion, but it's in the small population of cells that we would miss it. So part of the study is that we looked at how good we were at detecting mixtures of normal and abnormal size repeats, and we're able to detect up to about 5% contamination. So in other words, we can't say that there are no expanded repeats, but we can say that the population of cells with an expanded repeat cannot be more than 5% of the amount of cells in the tissue section that we've taken.
Great. So your study was looking specifically at the most common cause of ALS, the C9 expansion. Have you or others had the chance to look for somatic mutations in any of the other known ALS genes?
We are doing that. So we are looking at all the other ALS genes, and this is incomplete, so we haven't reached any conclusions yet. The challenge there, again, is detecting mutations that are present in only a small fraction of cells. And we've had to develop, a new for us method, which is SM-MIPS. So that's work in progress. So hopefully we'll be finished in the next 6 months.
So as you are looking for mutations in neurons that might have been the triggering event or the triggering location for the spread of ALS, it seems to me a challenge that neuron or that population of neurons might have died already by the time you have autopsy tissues.
Yeah, that's a very important limitation. The only thing that is in favor of us being able to find it is that if the somatic mutation occurred early enough in the formation of some segment of the spinal cord, we know that these precursor cells then lead to the formation of glial cells, of interneurons, as well as motor neurons. And we know that the glial cells don't die, and a lot of the interneurons don't die. So in the population of cells, yes, the motor neurons will be dead, but will be gone, but perhaps some of these other cells will also have a mutation. So that's what we're looking for. Another method that we could do is single-cell sequencing, and that could work, but the cost would be astronomical to look for rare somatic mutations in spinal cord of patients. So, but as the price goes down, I think it might become a method that would allow us to go down to the single-cell level.
So let's say that either by that method or the one that you're using, you're able to show that some of these remaining bystander cells have these causative mutations. What implications do you think that that'll have for how we know or how we understand ALS beginning and how we understand how it spreads?
Well, if we do find it, and we find it in a number of spinal cords, it would suggest that there's some fraction of cases of sporadic ALS that would result from somatic mutations. And as I mentioned earlier, the somatic mutation would be in a section of the spinal cord, and that this region would start to degenerate, because of the mutation in the cells. So it's a mixture of cells that are interacting, would then start in a focal place. Like, for example, ALS starts focally, usually. And then once it started, then it would spread in a prion-like manner because of production of misfolded proteins, TDP43 or FUS or SOD1 or some other misfolded protein.
And so do you think that opens up therapeutic opportunities if ALS is basically toxic proteins spilling out of an affected neuron that had a mutation?
Well, it would support this prion-like spread, and it would suggest that blocking the spread would be a very viable and potentially beneficial mode of treatment. So if you could prevent the misfolded protein from going from one cell to another, you could theoretically halt the disease, and I think that would be very beneficial.
Yeah, I completely agree with that idea.
If somatic mutations can explain some cases of sporadic ALS, then theoretically, it might be possible to design a test, you know, like they do in cancer, liquid biopsies, to detect who will eventually develop sporadic ALS. In other words, if there's a group of cells that have, I don't know, a C9 mutation or a FUS mutation, you, in theory, should be able to detect that by looking at CSF, for example, and maybe even blood.
Very interesting and diagnostic test to look forward to in the future, potentially. Great. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us about your paper. This is Matthew Harms. I've just been speaking with Dr. Guy Rouleau about his paper titled Somatic Expansion of the C9ORF72 Hexanucleotide Repeat Does Not Occur in ALS Spinal Cord Tissues, which you can find in this week's issue of Neurology Genetics.
This is Bob Gross again. Please check out this week's journal, which features a study on the progression of cognitive decline before and after incident stroke, and an article on limbic neurochemical changes in patients with functional motor symptoms. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.